Don't miss it. Lamplighter Theater this Sunday, 7 p.m. on Broken Road Radio.
A good program. 12 minutes after the hour, Doug Greenwald is in Texas today. Doug with Preserving Bible Times, normally in Columbia, Maryland, just on the outskirts of Washington, but he's a world traveler too, and he's down in Plano, Texas today. Doug, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, David and Jim.
And David is here too. We're
morning, Doug.
Eager to learn from you about Advent. I look forward to this time of year with you because you've got such a lucid explanations. There's so many mysteries in the Bible stories of Jesus' birth, from Matthew to Luke, and two different accounts. So it's always fun to compare them and take notes and glean from these stories what we can. You were saying you had an adventure in the air though. What was this?
Well, last week I was out in Denver.
Yeah.
And so in Colorado Springs.
That's why we missed you last week. So, yeah.
That's right. And I was on Southwest, and it's a 4-hour flight. And I was heading out to the Colorado Springs area to do two things: to talk about Advent in context, or the real Christmas, and also to do an abbreviated version of some material we have, a very different paradigm on making disciples. And that weekend is called Making Disciples Jesus's Way. And anyway, I was in my seat at 30,000 feet, about 2 hours had elapsed into the flight, and I was sort of relaxing, leaning back, and mulling over what in the world would be a new and attention-getting, but appropriate nevertheless, introduction to the Making Disciples Jesus Way weekend in that teaching material. And, I don't know, within several minutes or so, suddenly I envisioned or had this view in front of me here of a tombstone. And on the tombstone was etched discipleship. Okay. And within a minute or so, these are all approximations, rest in peace came to my mind, which is normally a phrase, an old-fashioned phrase used for somebody who's buried. Mm-hmm. And then I put the two together, discipleship : rest in peace. And if I take the first four letters of that, it's D-R-I-P, drip. And as soon as I said drip to myself, I had another picture. And this was of the phrase, streams of living water. And I thought, there it is. There's my new introduction. The biblical vision for being a disciple of Jesus is that we will live in the experience and the journey of streams of living water. And what the Western Evangelical Church, the vast majority of the Western Evangelical Church, has offered to us is an occasional drip of water. And so there I had the juxtaposition between streams of living water and a drip. And as soon as I hit ground, I went into my clip art file here in Windows 7 and got a lovely picture of a tombstone, and I could drop in discipleship in perfectly placed on this thing. There was graphic number one. Then I went in and put faucet into clip art, and there's an old-fashioned grandma's faucet with one little drip of water just about to drop off the end of the tap. Perfect, I said. And then I put mountain stream in clip art, and up came this lovely picture of a mountain stream cascading down the hillside, so to speak. And I said, here is my introduction. And so I kicked it off by saying, and I'm going to come back to this, but let me finish the loop, at least on the introduction here, to my audience. I put these graphics up on the board, and I said, folks, our notions of Western discipleship need to die. We need to bury them once and for all. May it rest in peace. I had that picture up on the screen. What we've been promised is streams and rivers of living water. Had that up there. And the reason we have to put to death, we have to declare dead Western discipleship, is until we do, we'll never be freed up from our notions of Western discipleship to discover what making disciples is all about. So that was my new introduction. But back up to 30,000 feet, you know, this new introduction took about 3 minutes to sort of come into view. But for the next hour, one thought after another just came cascading out. I was just writing notes and arrows and drawing circles and putting phrases down and thought developments. And I realized, after about an hour of this that I had a whole new mini-series that I probably am going to kick off next year on our monthly reflections called Discipleship is Dead, parts 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. I don't know how many parts it's going to take, in which I'm going to deal with the evidence that Western discipleship is dead, a dozen fallacies that have contributed to why Western discipleship is dead, because my days in the medical world, the doctors would always say 90% of an effective therapy is rooted in a sound diagnosis. And then I'm going to go into a whole new paradigm of how I think we need to think differently. We need to repent, so to speak, to use John the Baptist phrase, which really meant totally revise the whole way you're looking at something, okay? Change your paradigm is another way to say it in our contemporary idiom. We need to repent about what we've done with discipleship. We need to get rid of that paradigm. We need a whole new biblical paradigm to be rediscovered contextually in the way Jesus was making disciples. And then I'm going to develop those thoughts on out toward the end. So I was really juiced.
Well, I guess you would. The creative juices were flowing and ideas were coming. That's terrific. A very special time. And I'm looking forward to that new series now. Hopefully you'll be willing to share some of that with us as we get
involved. Well, I'm already, yesterday I was sitting down at my laptop here in Texas, and I was starting to deal with reflection number one, and I can't wait to get back to it. No offense intended.
Yeah, it's going to be. Okay, we'll talk fast. Oh, Advent. Zecker, let me see if we can kind of ease into the topic this way. We had Dr. John DeLancey on with us yesterday, and we were talking about the shepherds on the hillsides in Judea and around Bethlehem, and it got around to the time when Jesus was born, the time of the year. And in talking to you, and I've always bought into your logic in this, that it was probably like June or July, probably an early summer birth, about the time the Paschal lambs were being born as well. And John said, well, you know, he kind of thinks it was likely to be a fall birth. And so I asked him, what's the basis for that? And he brought up Zechariah. Zechariah, of course, the father of John the Baptist, was a priest at the temple. And Luke tells us about his experience in the Holy of Holies with the angel, and the angel letting him know that his wife Elizabeth would be pregnant. And somehow, John indicated there were records. I don't know if they're written records or recollections or just projections of cycles, but somehow he said you could time the month probably when Zechariah served at the temple, and then you go forward 6 months, and that was when Mary and Elizabeth got together. Elizabeth was 6 months pregnant, and Mary had just become pregnant with Jesus. And fast forward, and it makes the birth in the fall. What do you think of that? Is there evidence there to support that?
To answer your specific question, the issue there is Zechariah served in the clan, if you will, of Abia. And the issue would be, are there actually records when the Abia clan, if you will, actually served in the temple? I don't know the answer to that. If they exist, it might well be in the Mishnah, and that would be what needs to be investigated and researched here. Let me deal with a broader subject. I just last night to some people from City Presbyterian Church here in downtown Dallas gave the real Christmas in context version 5.0. Mm-hmm. And the reason I call it 5.0 is because I've been doing these Advent presentations for the last 5 years. And each year, the presentation gets bigger, deeper, and wider than the year before. There is no bottom to the insights, the discoveries, the contextual clues that we keep stumbling across that the authors give us here. And so the more the Christmas story expands and the more we see in it, the more questions get raised. And so I just want to put that out there. Now, there are people who contend that they feel that Jesus was born in the fall, depending on how you want to define that word, around or during Feast of the Tabernacles, which is a late September, early October.
That's Sukkot? Is that what that's called?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the reason part of that is because when you read John 1:14, And the Lord, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. The word dwelt, the underlying Semitic word here, most people define as tabernacled.
Ah.
The Word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us. And for some people, that's the clue that he first dwelt among us. He first tabernacled among
us. Oh, we're losing Doug this morning here. May have lost him altogether here. It's Michelle Pilar and the Song of Mary. Now 26 and a half minutes past the hour, and I think we have Doug back. And Doug, we were talking about this notion that Jesus may have been born in the fall, and you mentioned the word dwelt and tabernacled. I've never heard tabernacled as a verb before.
Yeah, that's the meaning of the underlying word here. And before we dig into that thought a little bit deeper, let's go to the top and look down on this. The one thing we're convinced of, it's not a December birth. It's not a winter birth. Mm-hmm. There are various theories or different facts or different logic trains that people can use, and they have, to sort of conclude different dates, but they all end up being in like the same 90-day window of time, from maybe July 1st, until mid-September or something like that. So we can at least make that observation.
Well, now I had read that Paschal lambs, or the sheep, are bred typically in October. Now this may be the modern era where they still do it in some areas, but the sheep were bred in October, meaning that they give birth to the lambs in March and April. So if Jesus were to be born at the same time as the Paschal lambs, and maybe that's spread over a number of months, but what's your thought on that? Are you familiar with the cycles? Because I know you've been there.
From Jim Martin's book, Exploring Bible Times, his proposition or contention is there were two waves of birthing. It's true that the majority of birthing took place around April 1st, but there was a second wave of birthing that took place mid to late June, around July 1st.
Okay.
So there are two phases or two cycles, if you will, of birthing. If you accept that theory, then you accept an early summer or midsummer birth, then yes, you would have Paschal lambs being born from temple flocks under watch by temple shepherds the night that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, the perfect Paschal lamb, which would place that birth around the 1st of July.
And that tends to be the theory that you accept, isn't it?
I'm comfortable with that one. Mm-hmm. I can move it up another 30 days to around August 1st. Here's another way to deal with this, just to show you that the more you dig around, the more intriguing possibilities come to mind. Back to this John 1:14 verse, the Word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us. There are some people who feel that is John's way, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, of telling us when conception took place at the time of Festival of Tabernacles. Hmm. Because in the Jewish worldview, life begins not when you're born, but when you're conceived. And so if you accept that and you go, it's not quite 9 months, I forget how many weeks a pregnancy term is, from right around October 1st, that's going to put you in the July 1st time frame as well. So that's another interesting way to do it. And now there's another piece of data that you can factor into this, in that we read in the Mishnah, which is the codification of the oral tradition done around 200 AD by the rabbis, that the Davidic wood offering was mandated by the clan of David for every July in the temple. That factors into prior to birth night, years before, we feel that Joseph's been coming down from Bethlehem to Nazareth to spend every July to be part of the Davidic clan, dealing with the mandated wood offering requirements in the temple. Some wonder if the trip to the census in Bethlehem was also timed to for Joseph to again participate in the Davidic wood offering. And that raises two questions. If you show up in Bethlehem with a very pregnant wife, and it's around early July, are you exempted from the wood offering in the temple? I don't know the answer to that. But if you are exempted, then he could be, that's consistent again with an early July birth. If he could not be exempted and had to go to Jerusalem and participate in the Davidic wood offering there for a full 30 days, it may well be that this birth that we're talking about occurred shortly after his return from doing his 30-day service with the Davidic clan at the wood offering in the temple, which would then place this birth in early August. Another way to look at it.
Yeah, now you pointed out to us, too, that in Luke it tells us they had been in Bethlehem. I mean, you can't, we're always kind of, in our Western tradition, they got there that night, couldn't find room in the inn, and wound up in a stable. Well, you're saying we really don't know how long they may have been in Bethlehem.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that either. It's Luke who tells us that. For example, in Luke 2:6, Luke introduces that verse, while they were there, comma, the days were completed for her to give birth. We have no idea how long they were there, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months prior to this birth night. We do know that Roman censuses are not one-day affairs or one-week affairs. You know, I think we in our Western world here think, oh, a census, well, that's sort of like election night or election day, and everybody shows up at the same time. Well, not so. As far as we can discern, a census window of time probably covers about 18 months.
Well, a lot of people had to travel a lot of distance to accomplish that census, so I imagine it was planned over some period of time.
Yeah, so there is this issue of how long they were there, and it's a total unknown. But one thing we know is true. They didn't show up at 10 o'clock at night because everyone showed up during a 24-hour window of time that night to all participate on the census on the same day at the same time. And somehow Tom Burdett forgot to leave the light on at Motel 6, you know,
and the
vacancy sign
yeah.
was showing. Yeah. That's just total tradition, but there's nothing that can support that at all.
But there were inns, weren't there? There were commercial inns in the region.
Well, there were inns, but the underlying Greek word for inn is pandoxion, and the word that's being used in Luke here for inn is kataluma. Totally different word. Kataluma means guest room. Pandoxion does indeed mean inn. Now, that's the word that Jesus uses in the Good Samaritan story when he brings this battered, unknown person to an inn. It's pandoxion. And my guess is that was down around Jericho. Jericho's on a major trade route. It's probably a caravansary, a caravaner's inn. That's a rough and tumble environment. That's like walking into a biker bar with all the Harleys parked out front, you know. No man is going to take his wife into that kind of environment, let alone one who's very, very pregnant. So for me, that whole theory doesn't hold water at all.
Now, they would have been traveling in a caravan, though, right? They're not riding a donkey uphill from Nazareth to Jerusalem.
Well, that's a whole other phenomena. There are caravans. You never travel alone. In fact, that's part of the backdrop to the Good Samaritan story. Why in the world was this guy traveling alone? How stupid can you be? I mean, that's about the most treacherous piece of terrain in all of Israel, that descending road from Jerusalem to Jericho along the southern rim, the old Roman road there of the Wadi Kilt. No, you traveled in caravans. But here's another point. You travel in segregated caravans. This is observant Judaism. Men can't get very close to other men's wives. And so you have a male caravan, and then maybe separated by a quarter of a mile. Behind them, you will have a woman's caravan. So there's a total unknown here about how in the world did Mary and Joseph get from Nazareth down to Bethlehem? Roughly a 5-day walk at 16 miles a day, 90 miles total. Joseph would have been in the male caravan, and Mary would have been in the female caravan. But the one thing we have to strike from our visual memory is the two of them, the lonely twosome, covering that 90 miles all by themselves.
Wouldn't have happened.
No.
Fascinating stuff, Doug. I know you got to get to breakfast this morning. So,
I've got a little more time.
Okay. If you have, we'll keep you as long as you're willing to stay.
I had a question, Doug. That, you know, and I asked Jim, and you know, and I'm not saying that I didn't believe Jim. I'm just wanted to get a different viewpoint.
I would never
suggest that
never
I didn't agree
my
with Jim.
Mind.
Ah, I knew it never pass your mind. We know that Joseph was of Davidic family. What was Mary's family?
Odds are she's of the Davidic clan as well. I mean, that was the promise. The seed always passes through the line of the woman, not the man. And for David, for Jesus to have been of the line of David, Mary would have had to have been of the Davidic line.
Hmm. And it was common, too, to marry within your clan, wasn't it?
Oh, common. We could probably say no one would know of an exception. Hmm. Absolutely. Hmm. The other thing is you're born and raised and live and die all within a mile of where you were born. I mean, people don't travel here except to go to festivals. So the vast majority of people are born, live, and die in the same radius of 1 mile from their home.
You know, that explains something else, because I used to wonder why after they escaped to Egypt and were called back by the angel that they chose Nazareth, that was their home territory, wasn't it?
It was their home territory, but you know, that just raises a whole nother set of questions. If people generally live very near where the heart of the clan is, why in the world are these Davidic people on the Davidic line living in 90 miles north in Nazareth? You can almost say this is unheard of. And there's quite an explanation that goes with this. That I think is fascinating. We have to go back into the exile in 586 when Babylon conquered the southern kingdom of Judea and took all the smart young boys and all the merchant class up to Babylon. They didn't take everybody, but they took quite a few. And for over 400 years, around 400 years, this group just stayed in Babylon and grew and grew and grew and grew. And while they had the opportunity to return, and many of them did, many of them chose not to in the first wave of Ezra 1 return, and then there's the Ezra 2 return, and then there's the third wave of the Nehemiah return, all having to do when they rebuilt the walls and rededicated the temple in 516 BC. Most of the people stayed in Babylon for a couple of reasons. A, life is pretty good in Babylon. And B, they just did not want to return to their homeland as long as pagans were governing the land. Some of them remember the days, the glory days of Solomon and David, when Jews were governing Jews and are just ideologically against returning to their homeland until Jews can govern Jews again. Well, that's going to be an awfully long time. But when Judas the Maccabee in 167 BC starts a revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, who is an anti-Semite who was ruling the land, the last of the Seleucid rulers, the residual of the empire of Alexander the Great. Not only did he kill thousands of Jews, but he then sacrificed a pig on the great altar at the temple in Jerusalem. So incited Judas the Maccabee that the Maccabean revolt took place. And within about 15 years, they had purged the remains of the Seleucid Greek Empire out of the land. And for the first time since the glory years of Solomon and David, here we have Jews governing Jews again. Oh my, are we on a second phase of the glory years of Israel? And so the word gets back to the people in Babylon, hey, Jews are governing Jews now again. That hasn't happened in a long, long time. And so we think in about 130 BC, 120 BC, 110 BC, we have progressive waves of exiles returning to the land after 400 and some years. And you would think that they would go live in the south in Judea and be as close to the temple as they could be. But no, many, many of these people came back and settled in the north because they are messianic zealots. They're very familiar with the prophecy from Isaiah 9 that the light will shine in Zebulun and Naphtali. Zebulun is in the tribal allotment where Nazareth resides, and Naphtali is the tribal allotment where Capernaum resides. And they're aware that from the prophecy that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem, but they're convinced that his ministry will first appear, where he first will be seen in action, so to speak, is going to be in the north in Zebulun and Naphtali. And so these Messianic Jews are returning and saying, we're going to be where Messiah is going to show up first, not where he's going to be born first. And that ties to together with another phenomena, is most, the vast majority of the Gentiles who are in Israel at this point in time are all living in the north. And there's some good reasons for that. Life is easier in the north than in the south. You get better rainfall, you got better soil, you got more valleys, you can grow grain in, et cetera, et cetera. And so these Messianic zealots that are returning from Babylon in these progressive ways from 130 to 120 to 110 BC are Messianic zealots who are going to settle in the north, just like we're seeing these settlements today in the West Bank, you know, same kind of mentality. They're going to redeem this north for Judaism and for Jews. And their vision is to drive out all the Gentiles from the north and make it totally Jewish again. So when Messiah comes, there won't be any Gentiles in the land and it'll be all Jews and the glory days will unfold once again. And the worldview, the job description that these Messianic Jews have who settle in the north comes out of Isaiah 61. And you ought to read those verses, verses 4, 5, and 6. That's their vision. They're going to kick the Gentiles out. The Gentiles are going to become their slaves. They're going to participate in the wealth of the nations. And that's all part of their worldview. So when we get into the Mishnah, we find some records here about the clan of Natsur, who comes south from, or comes not south, takes the Fertile Crescent all the way around, a 900-mile trip to return to their homeland. And this clan of Natsur breaks up into three pieces and settles in three different places, up near Biram in northern Galilee. One of the parts of that clan goes to the Golan Heights. And the third clan settles in what we now know as Nazareth. And we think the name Nazareth, which is a New Testament town, it's not an Old Testament town, actually gets its name from the clan of Natsur. And so part of the irony of all this is that Nazareth is a hotbed of Messianic zealots. The Messiah was actually raised in their midst, and they missed the whole thing.
History gets awfully exciting, and you got to really expand your reading, your understanding, your horizons to take all this in if you really want to find the answers as to why things happened the way they did. Doug, this is just a delight.
You know, I felt like you asked me what time it is, and I gave you a history of watchmaking, but
no.
You know, but you ask, why are they in the north in Nazareth? There is an answer to it, but, you know, there's a lot of pieces of context you got to weave together to sort of see the panorama of why that would be.
Well, I'm just thankful we have a teacher like you around to enlighten us, because it is fascinating. It's important information. So much of us, so many of us kind of wander around the dark all of our lives, and we just pick up what we hear at church and in a few sermons and never get to the nut. And you've helped us immensely today. We'll let you go to breakfast and look forward to chatting with you again next week. Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times, the website preservingbibletimes.org. There you can sign up for Doug's monthly contextual reflections, which are a delight to get. They don't cost you anything. They come via email. And you get to read what Doug has to say and kind of keep up with Preserving Bible Times. So I'd recommend it. And you can link to them from our site at brokenroadradio.com.
Actually, Jim, if I can interject there, the December reflection, which I'm in the process of distributing this week, is called Angels, Shepherds, and Wise Men. More contextual reflections on the birth of Jesus. And so if people want to request that, just go to our website, sign up, or send us an email saying, send me your December reflection, and we'll be happy to do that.
Well, I'd recommend it too, because I've gotten it and I've read mine, and it's well worth the few minutes it takes to go through there. You will learn a bunch, as we always do when we get the chance to talk to Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. Doug, be blessed. Travel safely. Have a great time in Dallas. We'll see you back home next week.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Music from the Martins.